This is Frank Hymans recording an oral history interview with John Ross. Today is the 22nd of August 2005, and this interview is being conducted at Sans Souci, New South Wales. This will be tape number MPFH 16 Side A. John, okay, when we do these interviews, we usually ask for some details about each person. So can you tell me first your full name, please?
John Charles Ross.
And where and when were you born?
Born on the 17th of the 9th. 35 in Newcastle.
Right. Tell me a little bit about your family, John.
My mum and dad, they were both born in Newcastle. My mother came from Cook's Hill. My father came from Wickham. How they actually met, I'm not too sure. But my mother did take up a job early in her life at the Follies in Newcastle. She was a dancer in the Follies, and her father used to be down there every night that she worked to pick her up after work. He was like protected, very protective of her. The Follies was called Barton's Follies, and just trying to think of the guy, the head guy that ran the place. I have got his name inside, but I just can't think of who ran it. But there was Barton's Follies, and there was another one called Sawley's. She worked for both of those, and I believe she was very good. And mum and dad got married, and I was born when my mother was 20. My father came to Sydney from Newcastle when work ran out in Newcastle. He served his time as over at one of the big docks at Newcastle there. I forget, he did have a trade, but there wasn't much work in it, so he came to Sydney and got a job as a waterside worker. That's where he lived, at Millers Point. He got a job there, and when he got established and he made sure the job was permanent, he sent for us from Newcastle, which we came to Sydney, in a one-bedroom flat at 13 Lower Fort Street, Millers Point. Actually, it was Dawes Point. And we were on the second level, you know, just a one-bedroom flat with a little kitchenette, and we stayed there for a couple of years, and then we were lucky enough to get shifted down to the basement area, and it was a two-bedroom. And we stayed there until, I think it was about 1954, 56, and we shifted up to 56B Gloucester Street. And it was a much bigger apartment. It was two levels, and we had quite a happy life up there.
Now, the house you first stayed at was at 13 Lower Fort Street, wasn't it?
13 Lower Fort Street, yes.
Now, can you describe, can you take me for a walk around the house, like an imaginary tour of the house, what it looked like?
The whole block of apartments.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, well, there was the basement level, there was the ground level, and we lived up on the first level, then there was another level above that. And there was nearly two apartments on each level. And up on the first level, Mr. and Mrs. O'Brien lived up there. Mrs. Delmore lived in the front of that level. She was the custodian or the landlady. And I used to go down to their place of a night time and listen to the radio with them. All the old serials. I just like to think of them. Just trying to think of some of the serials. Should have no trouble. Search for the Golden Boomerang. No, I just can't think of them. And all the ads used to come on, you know, the Wyckoff ads and all those on the radio.
Who was Wyckoff?
Wyckoff. It was a cough mixture. Don't cough, take Wyckoff. You know, and there was Bonington's Canadian mixture. Oh, there was plenty of ads on the radio. That's how they survived. But you had nothing else to do but listen to the radio between about half past six till about half past eight, and I was in bed to get ready for school the next day.
But, so that was the family entertainment, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's about it. But when we first came to Newcastle, I was only pretty young. I was about four, too young to go to school. So Mum used to take me to the movies. We just walk up the end of the street and jump on a tram and go up George Street, and there was plenty of picture theatres in George Street, and we ventured into one of the other streets one day and we actually got lost. Couldn't find our way back to George Street. So we eventually got back home again, but we'd go out of the night time too. Mum would take me out if Dad was on night work. We'd get home a bit late. And if you missed the Millers Point tram to get right up to where we lived, you had to walk up. And it was a bit bit scary of a night time going up there with all the black coolie seamen. People used to be terrified of them, you know, but they weren't too bad. But there was a few haphazard moments down there, I believe, but we never really got involved in them.
When you say black coolie seamen, were they Chinese?
Yeah. All parts of the world used to come here. The waterfront down there, they were flat out getting an empty wharf. You know, there was right from Walsh Bay right around. There was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 Walsh Bay, and then you got into Darling Harbour, and there was bigger wharves around there, and then you got around to Pyrmont, and very rarely you saw an empty wharf. You know, there were ships here all the time and around Circular Quay. Very, very busy.
Now, going back to the house in 13 Lower Fort Street, which is, of course, at the lower end of the street, isn't it?
Yes.
You would have had a great view, I suppose, would you, from the front?
Well, we only had to... When we were up on the first level, yeah, we had a good view, but we were looking under the harbour bridge. But, yeah, it was only a matter of walking across the road, like 30 or 40 yards, and you was under the bridge, and you could just see right up until the harbour turned to the left to go out towards the heads. You could see right up there, Pinch Gut and all the wharves, all around Woolloomooloo, where the American ships used to tie up and things like that.
No, we haven't finished the tour of the house yet, so what was on the levels above?
Just more apartments, if you could call them apartments. I wasn't actually sure, but they just called them flats and flatettes in those days. Well, there was only... You walked in, there was no toilet in the apartment. It was a communal toilet and a communal bathroom everybody had to use. And everything was pretty scarce in those days. You even had to put pennies in a meter to have a shower and get hot water for a bath. There was no hot water supplied for you. You just had to use pennies for everything. And, it was... on a not a real brighter side of it, there was no toilet paper. Nobody had toilet paper in those days. They used telephone books. They cut them up and put them on a string rope and things, or newspapers. And lots of things we never had. You never really got good butter. But you couldn't afford it. And I can remember we had the rabbit man used to come around the street, soft drink man, the bread cart. Everything was delivered, like come around the front of the house and you'd go out and get it. But the apartments, well, they were livable. Everybody had to put up with it.
How many people were you in that one-bedroom flat? What was the size of your family then?
There was only my mum and dad and myself. Then there was Mrs. Dilmore, I can remember, and Mr. and Mrs. O'Brien. There was another family upstairs right next to us. I can remember a couple of names up there. Viv and Arthur Cookman. They lived up there. I think they came from Newcastle too. That's how my father knew them. Outside of the other people that lived there, I just can't remember their names. And next door, there was a guy in there, Mr. and Mrs. Barker. He was an American, either in the Navy or the Air Force, I'm not sure, but he was working over on either Garden Island or down at the bottom end of McClay Street down there. It's the Navy depot down there. Yeah, he worked there somewhere, and I used to go and get their messages for him, and he used to pay me an American chewing gum, which we never seen in Australia. You couldn't get American chewing gum out here in those days. And you were flat out getting Australian chewing gum, PKs and spearmint and juicy fruit and all those kind of things. But he'd give us all this fancy stuff, you know. I thought it was terrific. I couldn't do his messages quick enough for him, you know. But they were nice people. And there was a couple of other neighbours further down. There was Gordon and Peggy McCarthy. They were in the same boat as us. They had one child. Lots of other people who you've interviewed. Maureen Stapleton, her family lived down the road. They they did it a bit tough because there was Mrs. Stapleton, the husband. I don't know if he died or separated, but she had two sisters. There was Aileen and Raymer, and they were living in the same situation downstairs, just a small apartment. But they managed, and that the girls got married and shifted out. Aileen's since died down the south coast. I think she's died. I know she's very, very ill with... I know her husband died of the cigarettes, you know, lung cancer. She's not going too healthy anyhow.
What's Aileen's last name?
Aileen.
Oh, yeah.
She married, I'm not sure of her married name, but she was a Stapleton. And
was that Maureen's mother, was it?
No, that was Maureen's young sister. Maureen's mother, trying to think of her name. We just all called her Stapo. You know, she was a lovely lady. She worked with my mother at Alex Cowan's around at Millers Point in the paper mill. And my mother finished up with bad lung problems, and whether it was the paper dust. She did smoke, but she was only a very light smoker. And but it finished up killing her in here, whatever it was, whether it was the cigarettes.
Now, tell me a bit about the work your father did on the wharves.
He was just an ordinary wharf labourer, waterside worker. And in those days, they had to get called into the bin each day to see if there was a job. And if there was no job for them, and they went in and looked on the board to see if they'd been picked up, and they weren't picked up, they got appearance money, which wasn't very much. I'm not too sure how much it was, but it wasn't very much, but they got something. And then they later on they progressed into a gang system, and they got picked up more regular. They got more regular work, and but it wasn't a very good paying job.
What were the conditions like for your father and other workers there?
Well, it was all right if they were on the wharf, working on the wharf or in the boat, but I believe just listening to all of them talking, the timber boats was the worst job. They'd have to go up the river to a timber boat and either unload timber off the boat. It'd come out onto lighters. They'd have to stand on the lighters. And sometimes the big logs had come down and they had to stand on the logs in the water and sort of tie them together and make sure. And I know there was a couple of bad accidents down there. I think actually there was a few of them killed over the years on the timber boats. They none of them liked those jobs. They had to go up the river, you had to catch a little ferry, and they'd take them up the river and unload the timber.
Up the river where? How far?
They'd go from... used to leave just under the harbour bridge there, the ferry, and it'd take them up to... right up into Balmain or up into Piermont and over the other side, over Ball's Head over there. Yeah, they'd take them around.
Was this the timber that was coming up from the northern part of the state?
I'm not exactly sure, but I'd imagine it probably would have been. Yeah, from all the forest areas. But they didn't like it anyhow.
Did he also work in dangerous conditions, your father, like asbestos or something like that?
I'm not too sure about the asbestos, if it was in the hull of the ships or not. I don't know much about the asbestos in those days. I know I worked in it in a few factories, but I never got affected. I don't think we weren't there long enough.
What kind of stories would your father tell you about his work?
They all had funny stories to tell. All had funny stories to tell. They used to terrorise each other. I remember my father telling me a story one day about a guy that I played basketball with. He was a bit older than me. Maxie Phyllis, his name was. And he kept poking his head over the hatch, throwing things down at my father. And my father picked up a lump of wood, unbeknownst to Maxie. And Maxie poked his head over again. And my father let fly with a lump of wood and hit him straight in the middle of the forehead. And split his forehead open. They stitched him up and he was back at work. It was only a prank. And they were all best of friends. It was all right again. But they had plenty of excitement. And he took me along a lot. Like, even when I was... Once I turned 16 or 17, He was a pretty good swimmer, the father, and he was a member of the Domain Baths, the old Domain Baths, which was an ocean baths in the harbour. And all they had was iron bars to keep the sharks and everything out. And they'd go down there Sunday morning and they'd have swimming races. And they'd have a big concert after it, like they'd all get up and sing songs, or they might have a paid entertainer and they'd have drinks, and they had a good time.
What about the union? Was that very good in protecting the guys, their rights and so on?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think they'd have survived without it. You know, they got their conditions improved, and because there was lots of other people earning more money than the waterside workers, just trying to think of that. Old Jim Healy, he was the bloke that was in there for years and years. And his son, John, I remember him because he was the executor of my father's will. And I've still got it inside, actually. And they were a great family. The Healys, all the waterside workers looked up to them. They liked them. They were good for them.
So did you see any conditions improve then over the time that you know that the union was active?
No, well, I never had much to do with it to go down and actually watch their working conditions. But, I had to work in all kinds of weather. That they didn't, if it rained, they weren't sent home, you know. They had to work in, or sleet and snow sort of thing, you know. They had to go.
Now, John, I believe you went to school without shoes, is that right?
The first few years, yeah, hardly anybody wore shoes in those days. Even on holidays, I can remember going up to Newcastle on holidays up there and run around with no shoes on, go from where we lived in Dawson Street to all the beaches. We could walk to all the beaches and you'd go up there with no shoes on. Now if I walked out the front without any shoes on, the prickles would hurt you, you know. But we went everywhere, over the rocks and to the beaches and fishing over to Stockton and everywhere in Newcastle, no shoes. Yeah.
What about at the point?
At the point, as far as shoes go? Oh, yeah, I was into shoes before I finished sixth class. Yeah, most of us wore sand shoes to school, things like that, because when we left school, you had to fill in a couple of hours to wait for your mother or your father to come home from work. We'd all go to the playground, the local playground. There was King George V playground in Gloucester Street. It was very good for the children.
How would you say your mother's life was at Miller's Point? I mean, it was very hard for mothers, wasn't it, because they were mainly poor. How did they cope, those mothers, and your mother particularly?
Well, they had to go to work to survive, you know, once I got established. Once I went to school, Mum got a job at the Alex Cowan's around in Kent Street, Miller's Point. It was there next to the Dunbarton Castle Hotel, which is not there now, I don't think. And it was opposite the fire station there. And she'd worked from about, I think they started about 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, 4:30. And she'd walk to work. They'd all walk to work. They'd all, Mrs. Stable and work there too, with Mum. And most of the women from the point worked there. If they didn't work there, they worked down at Playfairs, where I started work after I left school. There was 200 on the staff at Playfairs at least.
Where was that exactly at the point?
Playfairs. Was in the corner of the Argyle Cut. And now it's called Playfair Street. I can't think of what the name of the street used to be, and that's where the clock tower is now. It's a very prominent place on the rocks now, the clock tower. It's all shops and arcades and everything underneath it. But that was Playfairs, and the back lane ran up to where I eventually shifted to.
And how old were you, John, when you started work?
I started work when I turned 15. I left school and started work at Playfairs. I worked as a bench hand on a sausage machine with a person that became a very good friend of mine, Tommy Moran. And I'm very good friends with his son now. Tommy died, and he looked after me. He lived at Balmain. He lived at Millers Point early in his life, and he settled in Balmain, and he looked after me, and I've worked there, and he got very friendly with the boss and his two sons. They were both boners, and that's old Jack Danzy was the boss there, and the son, young Jack, and the other son, Claude, they've both died, Jack's son, young John, he was the first grade football referee, John Danzy, refereed all the football in Sydney. Nice young man, he still lives at Earlwood. And I shifted from the sausage machine I was lucky enough to learn boning. They put me through that. And I worked at Playfairs for quite a few years as a boner, maybe three or four. And during that time, I got called up to do my national service. I had to go and do that and came back, and my job was still there. But then the meat game got a bit bad and I got laid off, and I worked at various other meat companies. I went over and worked at G.H. Elliott's. It was on the waterfront of Piermont. I worked there. I went from there to I worked out at Homebush for a little place called A.J. Bush's, which was a very, very big meat company, but they had the Homebush Boneless, they called it, a little boning shed there. I worked at Homebush Abattoirs for Mickey and Johnny Carp and Andy Carp. And I went from there. I worked for Nick Carlos at Mary Ann Street, Ultimo, for 8 to 10 years. Bill Spanos, the same thing at Alexandria. I worked for Bill. Peter and Johnny Andrews, I worked for them. Went out to Bourke in 1956 when there was no work in Sydney, and worked for Tancred's at the Abattoirs. We were caught in the big flood out there in 1956. I was going to work in a bus, but then the floods came and the bus couldn't get through, so we were going to work in a truck. Then the water got too high for the truck to get through, so we were going to work on the back of a cattle truck, which was about 10 foot off the ground. And I put up with that for quite a while, but it got too much for me. I had to throw it in, come back home. It was too much water.
I'm going to take you back to Playfairs. Can you tell me what the factory looked like and sort of what the work was exactly that you did?
Yeah. Well, you came into it through a great big double gate downstairs, and you walked into a big, big yard. And on the right-hand side was all the big butcher shop, where they done all orders for the Navy and various other places. Then you kept going straight out the back, and there was big freezers out there. And on the left-hand side, there was the cooper. He made all the barrels to put all the salted down meats in and everything that went overseas. Went up to the first level, and there was another big works there where they made all their own dripping, because they had a big digester there. They all were all the bones and things went down. They boiled down all their own bones, where everybody else used to send their bones out to can't think of the two, Texas Burns and another, I can't think of the name, in Alexandria, but Playfair's done all their own. And on that first level, when you went up there, they made their own dripping and they put it into 1 pound bags and they sold it. It was very popular in all the butcher shops. Those delicatessens, you could go and buy it anywhere. Then you went up to the next level, and it was the big work level where all the sausage machines were and the small goods machines. There was at least 30 people just worked in that little section there where I started. There was about 8 to 10 sausage machines, and they all held 200 pound of meat in those days, and you used to do about 12 to 14 fillers everybody did between 7 and 9 o'clock. And I've never sat down and worked it out, but there's a lot of sausages. And then after that, you'd come back and you'd start on the Frankfurts. You'd work on Frankfurts for a couple of hours or right through to the end of the day. And they had a big smokehouse. They smoked all their own Frankfurts. Any other various small goods that had to be smoked. And then before I became a boner, I left there and went over and I got a job in the section that supplied this the small goods factory with all the meat, and I was salting down all the meat that went into these great big tin tubs that went into the room, and it had to be in there so long before it was used to let the salt get through it and cure the meat. And it was shifted around every day. The room was changed around. And that's when I learnt that part of the area. Then I was taken over and learnt to be a slicer. And then after the slicing, I became a boner. And it took quite a few years to become good at it. I know that.
Must have been a bit of a smell around the place from all the smoke, was there?
No, the smoke room was up the far end. It never infiltrated the other part of the factory. They had it pretty well under control. I don't know. Up in that corner, it was very smoky.
Did the smoke drift across Millers Point? Or
No. There was never any complaints about that. No.
Now, there must have been a very big company to employ 200 people.
Oh, it was a big company. Yeah. A big family, Playfairs. Very prestigious family. I used to play golf. They had a golf tournament every year. It was played on their old home estate, and the golf course is still there now. It's the Eleanora Country Club over on the North Shore, up the top of Narrabeen Heights up there. And that was their old home estate. Monstrous big place. Overlooked the ocean, you know.
How did the people of Millers Point look towards Playfairs as an employer? Were they liked as a company?
Yeah, well, they had to like them because you wanted a job to go and work there. But I suppose a lot of people used to say, well, why should one family have so much money? I don't know how they accepted it, but they did. And the Playfairs knew nearly all the families on Millers Point because somebody from the family had worked there at some stage through their life. Well, the Playfairs boys, well, David was about my age, I suppose. He might have been a little bit older than me, but his other brother, Peter, he went to the war. He was a POW, Peter Playfair. And there was Ross, and there was Strath, and David. And the Brigadier, old Jack Playfair, you know. But, yeah, they kept to themselves. They were pretty good. David Playfair, he was a nice man. Like, I had a rough time with him early in my life, but well, I came back and worked there two or three times later on through my life, you know. I got on quite good with him. He gave me a job of doing an expo for Japan. I think it might have been the 1980 expo. And they came in there and done a little movie of me boning out a chuck and blade, you know. And I didn't get to see the film, but I believe it. It went over pretty well over in Japan.
Yeah. Just make an announcement, John. This is the end of tape number MPFH16, side A. This is the start of tape number MPFH16, side B. Right, now, let's talk about other things like sport. What kind of sport did you play?
Oh, when I was at school, I played a little bit of football, not a lot, but I got very interested in tennis at school. And sort of after I left school, I got involved in tennis, and we formed a little tennis club, and we played around at Millers Point in Kent Street. The tennis courts are still there, and we used to hire the court out of a Saturday morning. We had the court for about 4 hours of a Saturday morning from about 8 o'clock in the morning till 12 o'clock. There'd be a regular group of us, and we formed a bit of a club. We played there one night a week also after that, and with the chap I mentioned earlier, Tommy Moore, and his brother Jackie Moore, and myself, another guy called Pat Armstrong. He owned the Palisade Hotel at the time down the rocks, and there was a couple of others. I just can't think of everybody's name, but and we put in 2 shillings a week for the year. And at Christmas, we had enough money because one of the guys worked as a Standard Brothers launch driver. A lot of people work for Standards too at Millers Point. And he fixed it up to get a boat for us for the night. And we all went out in the harbour. We had plenty of beer. We had plenty of prawns, oysters. It was, to do it now, it'd cost you an absolute fortune. I can remember we went over and we tied up at the Naval Depot over near Luna Park. Not Luna Park, the zoo. And we must have been making a bit of a noise because they got the longboat out from the Navy and come over and asked us would we either keep it a bit quiet once they found out we were causing no trouble, it was all right. Or either that or we'd have to shift somewhere else. But we were fine, they left us alone. But that was my tennis, and I carried on in tennis later on and became pretty good. We won a competition. But the playground is where we all learned to play sport at. We all played basketball for the playground. Into playground basketball, with over to Piemont, to Maybank Playground, out to Moore Park Playground, Coronation Playground up the back of the railway. There was another one at Woolloomooloo Playground. And the five playgrounds just played inter sport usually all the year, whether it was racquetball, paddle tennis, basketball. They were the main sports we all played. And then one of the superintendents came up to King George V Playground, a guy called Frank Britton. He was an American. And he was joining the basketball with us for quite a while until he pulled out a baseball glove one day and started to throw a baseball around. We all thought, this is all right. Then he brought in a few more gloves and he taught us how to play. And we'd go down the park and play, and then we formed a team. We weren't terrific, but we went all right for a little while. And then we got the opportunity. The guy that owned the big hotel down at Millers Point, what's the big hotel at the point on the corner?
The Lord Nelson?
The Lord Nelson, that's it, the Lord Nelson. A bloke called Dadda Pierce, that was his nickname, Dadda. He sponsored the Waterside Workers football team that played out at Waverley Oval of a Sunday afternoon. And he said, would you like to play for me? So we formed a baseball team called the Nelsons. And he bought us white uniforms with red piping and the red Nelsons written across the front and the back. And we went out and we played out in at Paddington, down there at the in the park. And we went quite well in the competition. We won a competition. And he was very proud of us. And without the playground, I don't think we'd have survived around there. I don't know. You'd have probably got into trouble, like all other kids did in different areas in those days. But it sort of kept us out of trouble. It was good.
Great. So what about swimming? Where did you go swimming?
Well, I started off with my father down the Domain Baths down there, and then when I went to school at Paddington, we went out and we got our bronze medallion, got all my medallions for life saving out at Bronte Baths, right on the corner of Bronte Beach there, Bronte Baths. And we went over and we used to swim in the swimming carnivals over at the Olympic Pool. I wasn't a terrific swimmer, but I ran third in the breaststroke. That was about as good as I got in the competitive swimming, but I could always save myself. I loved the surf, went to all the beaches, and we used to go out to Maroubra. We'd go to Bronte, or we'd go to Bondi. They were the three beaches we used to frequent. And we had a good time. There'd be five of us, we'd meet up, and we'd jump in a taxi. Only cost us a shilling or 1 and 6 each, and we'd get out there and in a taxi and come back home in a taxi, and we had a pretty good time as kids, really.
What about when you were a little bit older, like in your teenage years and young early 20s, what sort of social activities were you engaging in?
I'd done a lot of dancing. Maureen Staple and her sisters, they taught me the fundamentals of dancing just downstairs in where they lived in a little 12x4 square. You wouldn't believe you could learn to dance in that, but I did. And they used to go to a dance studio opposite Wynyard Station called Jimmy Anderson's. So I used to go up there with them, and there was dancing instructresses there and instructors, and I learnt to dance there. And then it became more of a social night rather than a learning thing. We'd go to these other dancing studios that were around Sydney. They were pretty good. There was Seagars was one. There was one in Pitt Street. We used to go there. It was good, and they had a Sunday afternoon dance there. The Bing and Swing Club, they had a dance there. There's one up in Oxford Street, Paddington, Professor Ballot's. It was good. But it's, and then we used to have our own, the CYO dance in Harrington Street, in the church hall there. We'd have that about once a fortnight. That was good. And but it was very popular, the dancing. We used to go to the Wolfie's Ball every year at Paddington Town Hall. Yeah, we had a pretty good time.
That must have been an occasion, the Wolfie's Ball.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, several times there. We all used to get on the back of the local Fruto's truck, the fruit truck, and we just all go out and come back on the back of the truck with your suit and your tie on.
I can't imagine Wolfie's being done up in a tuxedo.
Oh, they didn't wear tuxedos, but they wore a suit and a tie. Yeah. They all got dressed up.
Didn't go as far as tuxedos, right?
No. Not that brilliant, no.
What was the religious scene at Millers Point?
I suppose it was just about 75% Catholics, because St Patrick's Church was very popular, St Bridget's. I was a Church of England myself, and I used to go to the Sunday morning, I forget what it was called. It was up at St Philip's Church for the Church of England. It was a very big church. It was good, but the CYO, the Catholic Youth Organisation, they used to run things pretty good around Millers Point. It was very good.
Were there certain streets of Millers Point that were more Catholic than others?
There was never any trouble between them. Like, no, we all mixed in pretty good, I'd say. Well, actually, there was a few of the young girls down there. They grew up to be nuns and things like that. And I think there was a couple of brothers come out of the point too.
They told me that the Catholic girls were the only ones that had their ears pierced and used to wear earrings. Is that right?
I don't know much about that. You could be right, but no, I don't remember that part of it, the Catholic girls. But
now, tell me a little bit about the street life in Millers Point, the characters around the place and the happenings. So.
Yeah, there was a few characters around the point, the street life. There was a lady around there, like if you went to the hotels of a night time after they did open of a night time. There was one lady, Mary Bennett. She was a very good piano player. And she could play the piano, you know. And she'd go around to different hotels and play the piano for the night. And there was another lady too that could play the piano. Just trying to think of her name. She'd do the same thing. And there was a very likeable man around there, McCudden. I know the boys, Tony, I see him. We have a reunion every year, around about May, and they come from Queensland and everywhere for it. And you look forward to meeting him. But his father, Al Hock McCudden, yeah, he used to do a little soft shoe shuffle outside the little dance. You'd say to him, give us a dance, you know, and he'd break out into a tap dance. He was very good at it too. But there was plenty of characters around the point when you look back on it. And one of them, he was a wharfie, Lofty Stig. He was an ex-boxer, and he had a flat nose kind of thing. But everyone used to send him up a bit, but he was a lovely man. I think he held the heavyweight title in Queensland. He won the Queensland heavyweight title as a boxer, but he was a nice man. Plenty of good families from Millers Point. A lot of them still down there too.
And I believe the community spirit was quite strong. How did they help each other, the families? What would be their situation?
Well, a lot of the families were probably interrelated through marriage and things. And well, if ever anybody got hurt or something happened, somebody would organise a benefit. You'd have a benefit, whether it be in the Abram Mott Hall, which is the popular name, I think it's called that now, but we used to call it the Louse House. That was its nickname.
Why was that?
I don't know how it got its name. It was pretty sleazy. The Louse House, yeah. A lot of people got married there. Well, Maureen Sable and Jimmy McDonald, they had their wedding in there. I went to quite a lot of weddings in there. But that's where they used to have a lot of the functions. There, we'd go in there, they'd charge you so much to go in. They'd have raffles and things like that, and they'd raise a lot of money and help the family out. And that's the way it was, you know.
A great spirit, I mean, it's hard to find now, isn't it?
Oh, even the publicans that owned the hotels, they'd been there for years, they'd throw in, yeah, or supply some free beer, a keg, they'd all put a keg in, things like that.
What was life like in the pubs? Tell me the things that used to happen in pubs and what people used to do there.
Everybody used to have a regular hotel to drink at. Look, sometimes you might stray down and go down to somebody else's hotel one night. You'd know everybody, so you were made welcome. But all the same people were in the same hotel, and if a stranger come in, the pub would just go quiet until they sort of worked out who he was, what he was doing, especially if your pub had a bookmaker in it. And you're always on the lookout for strangers, and if a stranger come into the hotel, the bookmaking would stop until they sort of found out someone sidled up alongside them that had talked to them, or if they couldn't get a mag on with them, well, you just wait, and they'd lose their patience and walk out, and business as usual. But
tell me a bit about the SB bookmaking activities and some of the characters that you might have known.
Yeah, it was pretty open. The bookmakers, you didn't have to go far to have a bet if you lived on the point. There was one in every little area, you know. There was a lovely old guy, Sess Moore. He was very popular. He was in the Observer Hotel, and he was also in another house in Lower Fort Street. And then he was down further in Windmill Street. He had one down there. He had a good staff. It was the same thing. You had to go around the back lane to get in there and have a couple of cockatoos. And if somebody came in that shouldn't be there, well, it was just closed down. But it was usually, I think it was well organised, that, you know, the no strangers did get in there too often until later in the years, and it was pretty hard to keep your eye out where they were coming from. But he was very good. Then you went up further up to the other area, up to the Rocks area, and another lovely man, Sester Boyce. He used to work in the Glenmore Hotel, and his wife even took bets. She worked around further in Gloucester Street, just along from where I lived, and you'd walk in off the street and put your bet on. And they'd get the prices, and you'd get paid after the race. You didn't even have to wait till after the last race to get paid. Then there was the hotel on the corner, the Australian. I worked for Sester Boyce myself, and Andy's wife, Marge. And then I finished up working for another bookmaker up there, and then one day he just said to me, "Do you want to take it over yourself?" I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll give it a go." So I've got a good friend of mine, I won't mention his name, because he's still alive, and we run it for quite a few years, and we branched out. We've probably got another five or six hotels in different areas.
You were a booker yourself then?
Yeah, yeah.
Did the cops know about all this?
We got pinched once there, you know. But a lot of people used to pay protection money, but we never did. I don't know. But it got a bit hot. Everybody had to close down.
So when you got pinched, what did they do with you?
They just took somebody from the establishment. They didn't come in and take everybody. And he went to court on the Monday. He was a good friend of mine. We went to court with him, and I think he got fined about $50, something like that. I just forget how much it was. It wasn't too much.
And he'd be back in business the next day, would he?
Yeah. Yeah.
Great, isn't it? Right. Okay. Just before we move on, I just want to go to the Second World War. Do you have any memories? You were pretty young when that happened, but do you have any memories of any troops going or leaving or coming?
I remember when the big boats used to come in, the big American ships used to come in. I can remember one as if it was yesterday, just looking across. It was my name. Like, I don't know why. the Sir John Charles Ross, and that's my name. I can't believe it. There was a big warship down there. That's what it was called, you know. But yeah, Millers Point was all there, and between Millers Point and the railway, it's just seamen, you know, like American sailors, and they used to come up to the basketball court where we played at King George V Playground. Once they found out off the aircraft carriers that there was a basketball court there, they'd come up and play the local side, you know. It was great for the area. Even at Luna Park, you couldn't move over there for sailors, you know, off all the boats. But, I can't remember a lot about it, but I can remember the end of the war, being in Lower Fort Street, and we're all dancing. They sent us home from school. We never went to school. I can remember that.
What, dancing in the streets in Lower Fort Street?
Yeah, yeah. You wouldn't have got hit by a car. There was no cars there, you know. Yeah, only the trams. Well, I showed you a photo there of Lower Fort Street. Not one car in it that I took. But, yeah. I don't remember a lot about the war, but I remember the American planes after the war did a flyby, and a couple of the Spitfires went underneath the Harbour Bridge, and a lot of people, they wouldn't believe you that they flew underneath the Harbour Bridge, you know. Like our Spitfires and American fighter planes. And
now, in those boarding houses in Lower Fort Street, there were lots of seamen, weren't there? Tell me a bit about those characters.
Yeah, there was a lot of seamen, but a lot of the younger people from Millers Point were seamen. They went away on all the boats. I can remember a lot of them being on the boats. The friend of mine, that son friend of mine, Johnny Moore, and he was on the boats for years. He still is. And they'd be on coastal boats, or a lot of them were on boats that would go away for 6 months, and they were the merchant seamen. They were that. If you went away on a long trip for 6 months, you come back. You had 6 months off, and you got paid for those 6 months while you're off. And if they went away for a month, they came back. They had a month off. My cousin from Newcastle was on the boats, and he used to come and dock out here at Botany Bay. He was on the tankers. And his brother too was a seaman, yeah. Yeah.
Now, was the population of Millers Point fairly homogenous? Were they mainly Australians, or were there some ethnic or new Australians coming, do you think?
Wasn't many new Australians around in those days. I can remember working at Playfairs when I started there, and there was, in the small goods factory, there was one. He was a German, and people, you know, I don't know, it was because of the war and everything, they didn't take too kindly with him. He had to put up with plenty of abuse and everything, but he handled it all right. When you look back on it, well, how could we be so bad towards people, you know? But no, there wasn't many new Australians at Millers Point in those days.
Were there any Chinese?
Yes, I went to school with two lovely Chinese girls and two Chinese boys. The two girls were twin sisters. Their name was Audrey and June Ma. Funny you should ask me that. Audrey and June Ma, and their parents owned Checkers in those days, years ago, down in Pitt Street.
Was it the nightclub, Checkers nightclub?
Yes, yes. And the other two brothers, Lionel Cummings and Eric Cummings, they finished up owning a big garage in Chinatown opposite the Trades Hall. It's gone now. They sold it for something like $9 million. And there's a big Chinese complex there now. I used to go to the races a lot. I don't go much these days. I owned race horses, and I used to go out there and I used to see them at the races. But I haven't seen them for quite a few years.
Now, John, tell me a bit more about the house at 56B Gloucester Street. I believe it had an unusual feature.
Yes, it did, and we didn't actually know how far the feature went until we we surveyed it a bit more. It was down in the cellar. It was a cellar bathroom. We had a wash tub down there, a copper, and there was a door in the corner. And my father got it open one day, and he went in and we had a look around, and there was a lot of water seepage and everything. But it went from there right down underneath the Argyle Cut. And I believe it came out down the waterfront somewhere, but we never ventured to go down that far. You couldn't see too good, and it was very slippery. But I believe that's where they got the Chinese, the seamen for the boats, the people they wanted to make up a boat crew.
They used to kidnap them when they were drunk,
yeah,
there.
Yeah, so the story goes, yeah.
So that tunnel began under your house?
Yeah, that's where it started from. Yeah, underneath 56B Gloucester Street. I don't know if it's been sealed up since then, because before we lived down there, after my father died, they came and asked my mother, would she like to... they'd just done a few places up the end of the street, modernised them and put upstairs toilets in and bathrooms and everything, and asked her would she like to shift. And she didn't really want to, but we talked her into it, and she shifted up to 48. And then they done 56B up, but I've never been back in there since it's been done up, or whether that area's been closed down in the cellar, or I don't know.
Right. You didn't venture down the tunnel very far, huh?
No.
So how did the area change during the time you lived there? I mean, was there much demolition or changes going on in the buildings or the physical look of the place?
Yeah, it did change a lot. Like, a lot of the old houses that used to be housing became offices. And out the back of 56B, like out of Mum's back bedroom, you could just sit there and look out and watch all the fireworks from Fort Denison and all that. And now you can't, because they've put up big office blocks right up, cover the lot of it. You know, they take up a hell of a big area. But I don't know what the offices are, really.
Were there many buildings demolished at all while you were there?
No, not. Yes, only right around at Millers Point, right around where the wool stores were. Because I'd done a little bit of work in the wool stores around there when there was no work in the meatworks, around the back of Merriman Street. If you walked into Merriman Street, going out past the Palisade Hotel, there was all houses on the left there, and there was the wool stores. And all the wool stores are gone now, the houses are gone. There's only houses on the one side of the road now.
Were they demolished to make way for the tower, the MSB tower?
No, I don't think so. There's nothing there, really. No, where the wool stores were, there's nothing there.
Why do you think they were sort of taken away?
I don't really know. Because there was another lot of wool stores there in Kentstra, in Windmill Street. They're not operable now. I don't know what they're really doing there, whether there's offices in there or...
No, they put some offices, I think, there.
Did they?
Mm.
The old wool stores there, yeah.
Office space.
Brazcos, yeah, it was.
Did the wharves undergo many changes too while you were there?
Well, now they have. There's nothing there. The wharves are not used. They're. I know a friend of mine took over one of the wharves over at Piermont, and he turned it into a car park, long-term car parking for people. It's much cheaper than the one at the airport, you know. And I don't know if they drive them out to the airport when they go away or what they do. If you want to leave a car there for 12 months, you can leave it there. But and they've turned Walsh Bay, a lot of those wharves down there are restaurants. Like, you've got Pier 1, that used to be just a wharf that the ships used to come into. And they've got, I think they've got a lot of theatres down there in some of them now.
A lot of the shops have gone as well. Tell me about some of the shops that you remember.
Oh, yeah. In Lower Fort Street, there was a fruit shop there owned by Mr. and Mrs. Leonard. And there was a grocer shop on the corner. I don't know if the grocer shop's still there. I think the fruit shop's still open. And down in Windmill Street, there was a little shop there called Bays. I don't think it's still open. It may be. There was another one on the corner of right opposite the Lord Lord Nelson Hotel, there was two or three shops there. None of those are there now, but they're used for housing. Charlie Conran had a shop there, a milk bar. All the other shops are still there, but you go down George Street North, there was a lot of little shops down there that are gone, you know. They used to be, they've been made into bigger restaurants since, but when we worked at Playfairs, we used to go into one particular store there and you could have a very cheap meal. It was good.
Now, what have been some of the major events in your life that have happened at Millers Point, John? Like, did you get married there, or that you met your wife there? What happened?
No, I got married out at Randwick. I met my wife playing tennis. I got invited out to Bondi. They were short of tennis players. A guy I played basketball with, he said, "Why don't you come out and have a game of tennis with us?" I said, "All right." So I'd had my driver's license, and my father had a car, and I used to borrow the car, and I went out there, and that's where I met my wife playing tennis at Bondi. And
she wasn't from Millers Point,
obviously. No, she was from Randwick. Yeah, she was from Randwick. It opened her eyes to come down to Millers Point. Living it with mum and dad for a couple of years, it wasn't just like living at Randwick, you know. But she didn't mind it. It was all right.
We'll just take a break here, I think. That's the end of a tape. So this is the end of tape number MPFH 16, side B.